From London, the National Broadcasting Company presents War Telescope with John McVain of NBC's London staff, a veteran reporter of the European scene. For his regular Saturday report, we take you now to London.
This is John McVain in London. The recent reports reaching here from America again seem to emphasize certain differences between frontline troops who are doing the fighting and at least some of the politicians and other people at home. Later in this broadcast, you'll be hearing something of an episode in the life of a man of the front line, a naval flyer. Yet I wonder whether anyone who has not undergone his experience can understand it completely. The reports that I mentioned indicate one great danger to American national life, that people at home will shut their eyes to the fact that any sacrifice they can make can never be as great as the sacrifice of the frontline soldier when he risks his life. Once convinced, the soldier who at this moment stands in danger of death on the Italian front or in the air over Germany, that people at home do not realize how much he's been through, and you formed at least one basis for post-war disunity within the country. Lowe, the British cartoonist, put it very well this week. He showed a Colonel Blimp, clad only in a bath towel, running along the beach of a Pacific island. The figure was labeled American Blimp. At the edge of the jungle were American troops ready to attack the enemy. They were looking with mingled contempt and surprise at Blimp, who was clasping his hands to his side and saying, "Help, help, I've been wounded in the pocketbook." Your average soldier doing a frontline job doesn't have much time to read newspapers or listen to news broadcasts. He knows only the general outlines of some of the main news from home. What he's heard from home in these past few weeks hasn't been news of a kind calculated to instill him with any enthusiasm for the tribulations of the home front. Lowe's cartoon may well describe the general impression of an American soldier who heard only the bald fact that Congress, by a rousing majority, decided to call on the nation to pay only a small fraction of the war expenses. As far as the soldier knows, the reason was that Congress didn't like paying for the war because it was the president's idea. As far as one can determine, the average American soldier in active service does not approve strikes by labor. Neither does he approve a congressional policy of no control of prices and salaries. Complaints about high taxes and demands for higher salaries are apt to leave the soldier, living on sea rations in a cold foxhole that's under shell fire, comparatively unmoved. He knows what his salary is going to be for some time to come, provided he lives long enough to spend it. As regards the reports about the soldier's vote, the soldier is not at the moment vitally interested in politics. But his general impression is that the president and some other people wanted to fix it so he could vote. And then his own elected representatives in Congress turned thumbs down on the idea. The soldier wasn't terribly anxious to vote, but he's left with the feeling that somehow the home front politicians have gypped him. On the question of post-war aims, the soldier hears from time to time reports that some senator or other is working himself into a lather about American air bases all over the world, oil pipelines in Arabia, and similar subjects. Occasionally, he may read in his local paper a blast against America's allies, Russia and Britain. It's all very confusing to the soldier. He's beginning to be convinced that the goodwill of the people of other nations is well worthwhile. On the Italian front, he realizes that unless the French battalion on his right and the British on his left hold firm, his own fate is settled. If he flies a fortress, he may owe his life to a British Spitfire. He knows that without the Russians, his chances of success would be very slim. Things like goodwill, qualities such as self-sacrifice and international understanding, are beginning to be something more than phrases to the soldier. Yet few echoes of this state of mind return to him from the home front. It would be unfortunate if the frontline soldier were to get the impression that American national thinking has not risen above simple acquisitiveness in his absence. It would be equally unfortunate if he were to come home with the impression that his elected representatives had not treated him fairly. In either case, the soldier's resentment would enlarge the gap between himself and those who spent the war in America. The distinction of battling Japanese in the Pacific and Germans in the Atlantic is one that few American fighting men have yet enjoyed. Today, I've brought to talk to you an American naval flyer who's done just that. He's Lieutenant Kenneth Wright of Burlington, Kansas. He's one of the U.S. Navy pilots who take off from British bases and sweep over the Atlantic in a long, lonely hunt for German submarines and surface vessels. For many days, no sight of the enemy may break the monotony of the air sweeps. But when things do happen, they happen fast. And Lieutenant Wright's last flight was his most exciting and dangerous of the war. But to begin from the beginning, When were you in the Pacific, Lieutenant?
I was out there from September 1942 to January 1943, flying a Catalina from a base in the New Hebrides.
Looking for submarines?
Yes, but our main job was to hunt the Japanese fleet, but we never did find it.
And you run into any air combat?
On my first operational flight, we ran into a Japanese four-motored seaplane. We came up behind him and started firing, but he peppered us with 20-millimeter cannon shells and got away.
Did you see much of the war out there?
When the U.S. Naval Task Force met the Japanese Task Force at the end of November, we sat on a hill in Tulagi and saw the whole fight taking place a few miles offshore. Next morning, we flew out and spotted survivors for our PT boats.
When did you shift over to this theater of operations?
I spent a few months last summer flying in the North Atlantic Patrol from Newfoundland. Then we came to Britain. Our U.S. Naval Squadron works as a part of the British Coastal Command. There are only a few Britishes at our particular base, but most of us at this station are Americans. We also see a lot of Polish and Czech fire from time to time.
I know that your flights last many hours and take you far away from any land in the Bay of Biscay. Do you meet many enemy planes down there?
Yes. We ran into quite a lot of enemy aircraft opposition at the very beginning. The Bay of Biscay is still no picnic when anything from 2 to 16 German long-range fighters are after you. We usually see them first and manage to get into a cloud. You see, our job is to attack submarines, not to try to fight it out with German fighters.
Mm-hmm. You've had credit for sinking at least one submarine, haven't you?
Three planes got the credit, and we were one of the three. A British searchlight plane first spotted a German submarine at night. The submarine submerged and escaped. But the next morning, another aircraft found and attacked the U-boat on the surface. That plane was so badly shot up by the sub's anti-aircraft fire that it couldn't drop its bombs. We saw a submarine at 8 miles away and dove on it with our guns going. The submarine was putting up anti-aircraft fire, but we weren't hit. We made two bombing stacks and left the sub down by the stern. Another liberator followed and attacked the submarine with machine guns. He watched the sub sink and survivors escape. Our squadron has had several brushes with U-boats. The German fighters, though, seem to come in streaks. You'll make your patrols without seeing any for a while. Then for a couple weeks, you see them regular. It may be just the way it happens.
What about this last flight? How did it begin?
Well, we were just finishing our patrol. We had already been out more than 10 hours, and we were about 100 miles from land. We were flying at 3,000 feet, perhaps 1,000 feet above the cloud layer.
Just taking things easy.
Yes. Then one of my men said that he saw two aircrafts going through a cloud 3 miles away on our beam. I switched off the automatic pilot and took over the controls. All of a sudden, two Junkers 88s burst out of the cloud 1,500 yards on our beam. I drove towards the clouds, but the German fighters attacked right into our starboard beam. They opened fire at 1,200 yards, and I turned into them to give them a full deflection shot. But the first plane was right on and raked us with 50 caliber and cannon shells from stem to stern. My top turret and tail gunners were throwing lead into the Jerry, but we don't know whether we got him.
Were any of you wounded by those cannon shells?
Not one of us. Our instruments were smashed, and the plane was riddled from end to end. My newest gunner had his microphone shot out of his hand. One of the boys had his heating cord shot away, and another had a bullet through his sleeve of his flying suit, so close that it burned his arm, but no one was hurt. The worst thing was that number one engine was out of action, and we couldn't feather the propeller. That set up a drag, and we were skidding along sideways at 1,100 feet, with a compass that had been shot to bits.
Not a very pretty predicament.
We jettisoned our bombs and threw our excess gear overboard, but we sank down to 300 feet. I was flying by instruments in the clouds at a full skid, the damnedest flying I ever hoped to do. The stream of oil started coming out of number four engine, and after three quarters of an hour, the oil pressure dropped, the number four engine was finished. Then I knew we'd have to land at sea, so I ordered the crew to brace themselves for ditching. There wasn't any heavy ground swell, so we went upwind into a 12 or 15 knot breeze, and made a full stall landing. The tail hit, and the co-pilot cut the other two motors. The first time we hit was bad, but the second one was like hitting a brick wall in a car going at 100 miles an hour. It ripped the bottom out of our plane, and the nose went underwater and mashed it in at a 45-degree angle. Water tore off the top of the cockpit, and the plane broke in two just after the bomb bay. The co-pilot and I were both stunned, but we managed to get through the water that filled the inside of the aircraft and climb out through the broken top of the cockpit. Two of the boys got out the wing rafts, and the co-pilot dragged me to one and stuck me on it. Five of the boys in the after section of the plane got out, two through the brake and the others through the hatches. One boy was stuck, and then another boy went back and to get him. They all floated on big oxygen bottles and finally reached the raft.
Well, how many of you got out of the plane?
9 out of 11. I've been told that that's the largest number ever to get out of a Liberator forced down at sea. The wings are high and the body of the plane takes all the shock. Our radioman, Robert Erdman of San Marino, California, and Thomas Ryan of Louisville, Kentucky, had sent out a message that we were attacked, and they kept sending SOSs when we lost our one engine. So the shore stations got fixes on us and knew where we were. Then they sent out the last message that we were ditching. Both men stayed at their jobs in the radio compartment, and both men were lost. It was dark by this time, and we didn't dare take the raft too close to the plane because the wings would have cut them up, and we would have lost everyone then. The wings stayed afloat for only about 5 minutes.
You must have been pretty well played out.
We were all exhausted, and one man was badly injured. It was cold in the open sea on a winter night. The sea was rough, and the waves kept breaking right over us. We had some emergency rations and very pistol, but no water. Twice it rained, and the cold was awful. The injured man died sometime during the night. One man had lost his shoes, so we all huddled together, and I lay with my face on his bare foot, trying to keep it warm. The other foot was frostbitten, but the foot I lay on was all right.
Were you in any danger of swamping?
Yes, the waves kept breaking over us. They seemed to go right through us, we were so cold. We bailed all night, and perhaps that kept us from freezing. Once during the night, we saw a light, but by the time we could get the very pistol loaded and fire a flare, the light had disappeared. When dawn broke, the sea looked very empty, and we were at least 50 or 60 miles from shore. At 9:30, we saw a plane, but it was too far away. Then for an hour, we waited, and then another plane came. I waited until it got a beam of us, then I fired a parachute flare. The plane was a Royal Air Force Sunderland out searching for us. He dropped smoke lights and circled us until we were picked up. At 11:30, though, Catalina from our base arrived at our last known position, which was given him from the radio message that we had sent. It was only 3 miles away from the position where we were. The Sunderland dropped us another raft because ours had sprung a leak. Finally, two hurricanes arrived and circled around us to protect us from enemy air attacks.
Sounds like quite a gathering.
It certainly was. All those planes going round and round us. The Catalina wanted to land, but I thought it was too rough, so I warned him off. At 3 o'clock, we saw two boats racing towards us.
Did you say racing towards you?
Yes. One was an RAF air sea rescue launch, and the other was a British Navy craft. The RAF launch was the faster. It beat the Royal boat by about 200 yards. The RAF boat started to take us aboard, and the Navy came up and asked if they couldn't have at least one survivor. But we all got aboard the air sea rescue launch. I don't remember much that happened then except some dry underwear, blankets, hot soup, brandy, and a warm bunk. Back in England, we went to the hospital because we all had some cuts and minor injuries. The most fed-up boy of the bunch, though, was one who found out an order had come through for him to leave for the States the previous day, the day we had set out on our patrol. But he didn't see the order until we got back to the base, after it was all over.
Thank you, Lieutenant Wright. Sub-hunting in the Bay of Biscay doesn't sound like a very soft job. After 600 hours of operational flying over both oceans, you ought to know. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the NBC Newsroom in New York.
You have been listening to War Telescope, a weekly report on the war as seen from London by John McVane, NBC's veteran observer in the British capital. Mr. McVane is presented each Saturday at this same time over most of these stations. This program has come to you from London and New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.